HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 306, recorded live Tuesday, February 14th, 2012. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Zoo City author Lauren Bucus about creating science fiction.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'm here in beautiful Wellington, New Zealand at the Webstock, and I have the absolute pleasure of sitting down with Lauren Bucus, who is the 2011 Arthur C. Clarke winner for her novel Zoo City. Also, you wrote Moxieland?
That's right.
And you're working on another book right now.
I'm working on a book about a time-traveling serial killer called The Shining Girls. That'll be out in 2013.
Oh, that's brilliant. Okay, so we have to talk about that in time travel. And folks that listen to the podcast or read my blog know that I'm really into science fiction, and I've been going through sci-fi on my Kindle at just a ridiculous pace. I'm actually about halfway through Zoo City right now, and I've fallen asleep with the book on my face, the digital book on my face, a couple of different times. I wanted to talk to you about process, because I think that's interesting to the listeners, and it's always interesting to me that we, as the non-science fiction writers, have a perspective about what it's like. You know, I assume it's this kind of amazing romantic thing where you're like in a cafe in a wonderful foreign country. You live in Cape Town, South Africa, and the words just kind of flow. You know, you're typing on like an old-timey typewriter, and then you rip off the manuscript you only have one copy of, and you turn it in.
Basically, I sit at a hotel pool and kind of lounge with cocktails and kind of type one-handed while, you know, looking fantastic in my bikini. No, it's hell on earth. It's, you know, it sounds terrible, and I know that there are much more difficult occupations and much more labor-intensive occupations, but it is very lonely work. You're locked inside your head all day making stuff up. So I actually rent a studio space so that I can have other people around and I'm not working from home. And I spend a lot of my time avoiding writing, which is ridiculous because it's a privilege to get paid to make up stories. It's amazing. But there's a lot of kind of wasting time on the internet. You'll see if you follow me on Twitter that I spend kind of the first 2 hours of the day messing around on the internet, and then I kind of go quiet. And that's when I'm actually settling down to work. And it's basically up until the point that I have to force myself to do it, that I can't avoid it anymore, that I actually have to knuckle down and actually do some work now.
Does it feel like work?
It does feel like work. I think it's because I've been doing it as work for, you know, I've been a professional writer in some capacity, either as a journalist or a TV script writer for the last, since 1997. So putting words down on paper is work. And it is also a joy, and it's tremendously exciting. As soon as I'm into it, you know, within the first 20 minutes, I'm having a fantastic time, and that's wonderful. But I will avoid getting there, and it's quite a perverse and twisted thing to do to yourself, to avoid doing something that you love that you've always wanted to do. I think it's just human nature.
Is that, I mean, procrastination by its nature?
Yeah.
It's just what we do?
Yeah.
Do you do any techniques to, like the Pomodoro technique where you set a timer and you're like, okay, I'm going to sprint for 30 minutes and then give myself a gift at the end of it?
I've been doing more kind of the Pomodoro sprinting stuff. But mainly I use Freedom, Mac Freedom, which is fantastic. It just locks you out of the internet. because I don't always have that willpower, but I am trying to build in more reward systems. And I think, you know, the most important thing for me is to not just be locked in my head. A few years ago, I got a grant from the National Arts Council in South Africa to write Moxieland, my first novel. And I locked myself in the house, and I wouldn't let myself out of the house until I had 1,000 words down on paper. And what happened was that I just had no stimulation, and I just kind of shut down. I didn't know how to talk to people anymore. And I know that sounds overdramatic, but I would go out and I would struggle to initiate chit-chat. And it was very frustrating, and it was very alienating, and you absolutely should not do that.
So that idea of the writer who has become like so involved in their own world and their own minds that they've lost the ability to speak sounds like classic writer. That's like such a cliche, but you're saying it actually does happen.
It definitely happened to me during that specific period. So what I've learned is that I need a space where there are other people around. I can still retreat into my own world. I put on my headphones, I play my music, and that's fine. But I can go make a cup of coffee. I can turn around and somebody can show me a funny YouTube video and, you know, just be able to be in the world and have people around. the other thing is, you know, I was a journalist for a very long time. And being out in the world, interviewing people, it's like a backstage pass to society. So you really get a sense of what is happening around you, and you're not just stuck in your cozy little enclave. And I think that's really important. I think it's really important for writers to be social, to be out in the world, to have experiences. And I'm not saying you need to go the full Hunter S. Thompson route, but you need to understand people. You need to be an observer.
How often does going out into the world and sitting at a cafe or walking in the mall give you that inspiration that you then rush back? And like, you see someone wearing something, or their hair is a certain way, or they do something, you see an interaction, and then that ends up in the book.
You know, I file that stuff. I don't run away and write it down immediately. I'm absorbing stuff all the time. Probably stealing bits of your personality right now. You'll see it rock up 5 years from now. It's not an instant run home and write it down. It's just kind of observing constantly and trying to find stuff. But one of the things I do like to do when I'm writing a book is to go on a recce, you know, to go and visit the locations. And I find that reality is much richer than anything you could make up. And I think you can see that in novelists who do their research, who've actually been to places, and you get such a sense of where this is, and that they've actually been there, and that they have a real understanding of this, and that I think it's the surprising details. And those little nuances, I think, are really important for me in my writing process.
How much of that is absorption versus how much of it is note-taking? Like, if you're going to go to a township, or you're going to go off into the mountains, are you sitting there with a sketch pad and writing stuff down, or do you literally just let it come in by osmosis and hope that you'll remember it?
It's a bit of both. If I'm on a recce, then I'm taking notes obsessively.
Could you tell me that word again? Explain that to our listeners.
A recce, reconnaissance mission.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Sorry, it's a terrible militaristic term.
I thought it was some kind of amazing South African word I hadn't heard of.
No.
Okay.
I think it's me being pretentious.
No, not at all. The book that you're working on now, you said, is a time travel book.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been just, for some reason, devouring time travel lately. And all the things that time travel books have in common, I think, successful time travel books, is that they're hard. They ask something of the reader.
Mm-hmm.
They assume that you're not an idiot. Very few, other than maybe Back to the Future, no time travel story assumes that the reader is an idiot. And they always make it one level deeper than maybe it would be right. That way you get to argue about it. Like, no, the wife came back, and then the people, and that was in the same time. It was his grandfather or whatever, right? I'm sure that when they were pitching like the movie Inception, they were like, this is way too complicated. And they're like, no, trust the audience that they're smart, right? When you're doing that, though, that means that I'm having to think, as you as the author, to make it self-consistent must be doing a lot of work. Where are you keeping all of this straight? Is it Visio diagrams? Are you drawing on the wall in marker?
I've got a lot of notes in the novel, and I don't want to talk too much about it because I'm vaguely superstitious that not that it jinxes it, but that it takes away the energy.
Okay,
let's
talk about the general concept. Absolutely. Of time travel books that you've maybe.
So
read.
Well, no. But so what I do with my research and with keeping my timelines in track is I have three different timelines. You know, it's about time traveling serial killers. So I've got his timeline. Which is out of order. There is the actual historical timeline. And then there is the book's timeline. And I have three different timelines up on my wall with different note cards, and I've got very detailed information on there. He leaves anachronistic clues on the body. So I've got to also track which clue has gone where. At one point he's injured. I've got to make sure that he's injured in the correct scenes. So it's a hell of a thing. And it is, it's this very visual map that I've got kind of scrawled across my wall. Which is also difficult now that I'm actually away from my office and my home, and I don't have that map to just be able to glance up and look at. So
you're still working here.
Yeah. I have to. I've got to deliver it in May.
And so that's interesting that you were concerned that maybe talking about it too much, and we won't, would take away the creative energy. But the fact that there's a looming deadline doesn't take away the creative energy?
No. I find I work best with a deadline. It's also, it comes from being a freelance journalist for so long. You know, you put the most urgent work at the front, and everything else kind of falls by the wayside, which is why it took me 4 years to write my first novel, because I was messing around. I didn't have a very hard deadline. And eventually the only reason I finished Moxieland, this is a terrible confession, is that I was going to get kicked out of the MA in creative writing program if I didn't. They basically said to me, look, you either deliver this book or you're out. And I did it, and I pulled it out, and it was easy. You know, as soon as I had a hard deadline, And then I wrote Zoo City in a year because I had a hard deadline. I got a 2-book deal and it was great. So I like having a deadline because it makes it creative work instead of art. And it, of course, there's art involved. And I'm not saying that I'm not trying to make the best possible book, but it's that whole factor of, oh, the muse is not with me today. I just can't do it. As opposed to, oh God, I've got a deadline breathing down my neck with lawyers attached on the other end. I better sit down and do this. And, you know, it's what I've done every day. I write every day as a journalist or as a TV script writer, and I've had to meet the deadlines, and it's no different with a novel.
In software, we have hard deadlines, and there's the old software joke where you can have it, what is it, good, cheap, or fast, pick two.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't the same thing apply in writing? Like, do you ever read your other stuff? Like, with code, at least I can refactor it and I can always mess with it and tinker. But do you ever go back and, like, look at Moxieland and go, oh, what was I? Chapter 4, I should have. No, it's too late. I published it. There's no revision. There's no version 2.
No.
Do writers do that?
Of course writers do that. Like, you know, a lot of writers have big issues where they don't want to deliver at all. You know, they're like, well, it's not finished. And they want to just keep polishing forever. And I think that's also a level of insecurity, that it's very scary to let something out into the world and see how people react to it. And of course, there are things that I would go back and tweak now if I could. But generally, I'm happy with them, and I like to move on and just move on to kind of the next project and tell a whole different story. I might consider a sequel to Zoo City, but I'm done with Moxieland, and I just don't want to go back there.
So that universe is...
Well, that particular... Even the universe. I mean, I was trying to do something very specific there. But I told the story that I wanted to tell within that. And I think I'm always going to jump genres. I'm always going to tell a different kind of story. The novel I want to write after this is about dreams. And the one I want to write after that is about the real-life occult crimes unit in South Africa.
So you're actually planning that far ahead. You have a sense of where you're heading.
It's not so much, you know, like, oh, I've got my 10-year life plan and everything's worked out. It's that these are the stories that are nagging at me. I think of stories as kind of developing in the dark room in the back of my head. And it's only once I actually start putting it, you know, I've got kind of the negative, but it's only when I start kind of putting it through the chemical treatment that I start to really see what I've got and really kind of have to work at it to develop it.
Is it a sense that there's a story in you and needs to get out, or is it a sense that there's a story out there and you need to follow it until it reaches its conclusion?
I think it's a story that's in me that needs to get out. And I always know my beginnings and I always know my endings. It's the middle bits that you have to fill in. There was a great analogy, and I don't know whose analogy it was, but it's awesome and I've stolen it, which is that writing is like taking a road trip at night. You know where you're leaving from, you know your ultimate destination, maybe you know some of the major waypoints along the way. The rest of the time you're driving in darkness, you can see 20 feet ahead of you in the headlights, and you got to figure it out. And that's really how I write. I know the major plot points, I know exactly how it's going to end, and there's a lot of kind of freewheeling, taking interesting detours. Books never turn out exactly the way I intended, and usually they're much better for that, and then I can just recycle the ideas that I didn't use.
That seems like very kind of big picture and very high level. Do you agonize over individual phrases and sentences? Because I know that when I was doing creative writing in school and I was not good at it, that I would just look at a sentence and I would get all wrapped up in the comma faults and the M dashes and the sense and just how did it flow and it didn't seem authentic. And then I would go and look at other writing that just is so soluble and it just kind of the conversations go back and forth. And how do you, is it having an MA in fine arts and writing that allows you to kind of get past the little details of how to phrase something?
I think it's 10 years of journalism and writing every day for a living. I think the best thing you can do if you want to be a writer is try and get a day job where you can write and hone your craft. It's like being a pro athlete or a pianist or a coder. You know, you actually have to do it every day and just keep honing and keep practicing. And that's how you get really, really good. And of course, there are clumsy moments and horrible sentences and that's what editing is for and that's what editors are for. And they will deal with the M dashes and the fact that I sometimes, you know, cross into pluperfect when it's, yeah. I think what's interesting for me is that there are certain parts of the writing that I have to work at more, which don't come naturally. Dialogue comes very naturally to me. And often my first draft is very dialogue heavy. And then I go back and fill in kind of the action and the scene descriptions around that. I think that also comes from being a journalist and sitting and listening to hours and hours and hours of interview tapes and transcribing them and really picking up an ear for how people speak. It's also being a scriptwriter, you know, especially I worked in kids' cartoons for a very long time. And in a kids' show, you don't have a lot, you can't go on like a 5-page monologue. You have to get that information across in one line of dialogue. The same with comics. I'm writing for Vertigo at the moment. My editor tells me if I go 2 sentences, I'm waffling and I'm not allowed to do it. So you have to make that sentence work so hard, and it's got to convey so much about the character, the subtext of what's really happening. And so that stuff is something that I've been honing for a long time, and that comes very easily. Where one of the places I struggle is action scenes, and I hope they read well, but those are the things that I have to work at the hardest. I really have to sit and polish and craft them and kind of really think about what's happening, kind of play out the cinematography in my head and sometimes act it out, kind of tumbling across, not quite, but, you know, I will sit there and make hand gestures because I'm thinking about exactly how that punch was thrown and how they're kind of falling into the sewer or whatever it is.
Do you talk to other people? Like, I spoke to another writer named Barry Eisler, who is like a spy. He was a CIA agent. And like his dialogue is fine, but his action is like all he does, because I think he was in karate or something. So he might go 3 pages over 6 seconds of action, because that's obviously what his thing is. Mm-hmm. And your dialogue and exposition is your thing. Do you go and say, well, this guy knows karate, I need to find a karate guy to tell me if this is how they do it?
I do consult a lot of experts, not specifically with the action scenes, but with Zoo City, you know, I spoke to several paramedics just to get kind of the medical information right. And I try to get as much kind of expert knowledge as possible. Zoo City also deals with refugees. And I interviewed a young guy from the Congo he'd walked down from the DRC to Cape Town. And I really wanted to get a sense of kind of his life, and he checked the slang and the language for me. It's very important to me to have that level of authenticity. I think it also, with action scenes, it also helps watching a lot of movies.
How do you keep from accidentally taking someone else's idea? How do you keep from accidentally plagiarizing? Because aggregation is a part of life, and the fact that there's so much information out there now. Like, I mean, Hemingway had his life and newspapers and the occasional silent movie, but effectively he was sitting in a cafe in Paris writing from his brain. But now we're getting bombarded. I mean, you're bombarded on Twitter for hours a day before you get your feet under you.
And that's also, you know, like reading Boing Boing and Nidorama and, you know, all the websites. That's kind of the start of my day.
So you're aggregating, but how do you make sure that aggregation doesn't turn into plagiarism?
I think it's how you use ideas. I mean, the first thing you have to realize is that no idea is original. You know, when I started writing Zoo City, and I'm sure you've probably noticed this already, it has quite a lot in common with Philip Pullman and his Dark Materials trilogy. I hadn't read that at the time, but as soon as I spoke to a friend of mine who's kind of a very good sounding board for me, he said, oh, well, it sounds like Philip Pullman, you shouldn't do it. And I was like, oh, really? But I really like the idea. And I went and I read The Golden Compass, and I was like, okay, this is a great book, and it's not anything similar to what I'm doing, and that's okay. So it's also about how you use the idea. The same thing happened when I was writing Moxieland. I read Margaret Atwood's Oryx and Craig, and I finished the book, and I was like, what am I doing? Like, she's just done it better. There's no ways I could actually compete with this. And the fact is that you are competing in a kind of commercial level and trying to publish and stuff. But if you can find a different spin and a unique take on an idea, that's really what you want to do. As far as research goes, you know, when I'm transcribing notes, I try to, you know, I collate from a lot of different places and a lot of different sources. And it's only if I'm using personal interviews that I'll kind of use something directly. And obviously with that person's permission. But otherwise, it's also being a journalist and, you know, specifically having to be so careful about plagiarizing. So it's really, I'll transcribe notes in a different way. You know, as I'm taking notes on something, I'll start changing the language immediately. So I'm very, very careful to try to avoid doing that.
Let's talk about Zoo City, because I'm in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm. No spoilers then.
No spoilers, but I think it's fair to talk about maybe the first couple of chapters.
That's fine.
Right? The kind of stuff you would flip through if you were looking at it in a bookstore. Because I want people to buy Zoo City, because I bought both Zoo City and Moxieland while I was here hanging out with you. In Zoo City, there's some, again, I'm not a writer, so forgive me, but I feel like there's some literary techniques that I've heard before. And this may just be how like Western writing is, where, you know, where are we? where's the context? Are we in the future? Are we in the past? Are we in an apartment? And you're teasing us by giving us just like a morsel of information per page. You know, you don't know if this is a woman or a man, and then you find out it's a woman. You don't know what color they are. You don't know how old they are. Is this something that you're consciously doing, this kind of dance? Is this, because this seems like this is inherent to sci-fi more than fiction, where you're making me wonder, and I'm slowly having to paint it together. Did you do that on purpose?
I like to make readers work. I think
it felt like work.
Oh, I hope it was enjoyable work.
No, it was just like, I don't know what this person looks like in my head. So I just have a blank face, and then I get hair, and then I'll get shoes, and I'm assembling my mind's eye's perspective of this person.
Look, I mean, some of that is South African shorthand. You know, a South African would immediately know that Zinzi was a black woman's name. And that's not necessarily, you know, that is something that I have to think about with international readers. I try to contextualize slang as much as possible so that you can gain the meaning. But there's stuff like that which I don't even think about. I'm just like, oh, figure it out. But I don't know if it's a specific literary technique. It's really just that I like to trust that my reader is intelligent and they can keep up. And I, you know what, the one thing I hate is the info dump. You know, that scene in the bar where the one character slings her arm around the other character and explains to them, like, what's happened in the world and how it's changed. And now criminals have these magical animals so you can spot them a mile away, and they're kind of rounded up into ghettos and kept segregated from society. That's really painful. I'd much rather let it kind of evolve. And again, this is a cinematic technique. You know, if you watch something like Children of Men, you know, in the first scene, he goes into one of my favorite movies.
It's an amazing movie.
So he goes into a coffee shop, and there's like a newspaper headline on the wall. And I can't remember, I think it's about the kid who's just died or whatever it is. But, you know, movies provide you with those little contextual clues, and they don't have to tell you that information. So I'm trying to do the same in my fiction, where there are these contextual clues in the background, and you have to kind of pick them up. But then there's also kind of information, and I've woven through a lot of kind of found materials. Like an IMDb page on a documentary, which kind of explains some of the phenomenon. I was trying to make it as much like our experience of the real world as possible, where we don't just get our source of information from one source. Mm-hmm. You know, we get information from absolutely everywhere.
How did you decide, like, when, like, oh, I'm on chapter 3, I'm on chapter 4. I think about now, the reader should have figured out what's going on. So now we can get into the meat of it. Like, how do you decide how to reveal? And then, of course, I'm sure you have big reveals at the end, but then also there's always the need, and I think it's part of the science fiction reader's personality, for a satisfying ending. There's like basically two kinds of sci-fi readers. The you better explain it to me all at the end, or I'm gonna like rage quit your book, or the you're gonna leave it wide open and I'll never know. You know what I mean? Like there doesn't feel like there's any middle ground. Either explain it in a way that works in the physical world and makes like self-consistent sense, or you completely leave me up in the end and there's no explanation for why this world exists. How do you decide that?
I like ambiguity. I think our experience of the real world is ambiguous. You know, what happens after we die? I don't know. You don't know. We've got theories. But no one knows that stuff for sure. So I wanted to have the same kind of ambiguity. There are a lot of theories in the book and you can develop your own. But I'm afraid, like some people, might rage quit.
So I have ambiguity in my future.
Yeah.
When you make a universe like this, like we were talking about before, like you felt with Moxieland, you told the story, that universe is over. Some writers like the idea of their writer's universe. Like, you know, like everything Larry Niven does is basically in the Niven universe.
The Ring World, yeah.
And then sometimes people will go and just write stuff in that guy's universe just because he's so amazing. I just want to be in his space. Have you thought about, like, it sounds like you want each book to be itself, its own universe, its own characters, its own timeline.
There are separate universes. I'm not particularly interested in going back to Moxieland because I told the whole story that I wanted to tell there. It's about a corporate apartheid state. And it's about security theater, and it's about, nanotechnology and, advertising, kind of mind control, and, you know, kind of a lot of things where we are really right now. And I said all the things that I wanted to say about that within the book. Zoo City is a much more open universe. I think Moxieland had a very kind of specific intent and purpose, and there was a lot, you know, there was a scathing satirical edge there as well. Zoo City, I could definitely go back to. The time traveling book, I think I'm going to be done when it's done.
Why could you go back to Zoo City? Because I feel like you kind of, if I may, you kind of light up a little bit. Like you have a fondness for that universe. Mm. You want to be in that space.
I really enjoyed the characters. And I think I could go back there and there were unanswered questions in Zoo City, not just about the universe, but about some of the characters. I still think the ending is very satisfying, although I might be slightly biased on that account. But there's definitely space to play, and there was stuff that I wanted to bring into the book. I don't know if you've got to the point where they talk about the dog fighting.
Not yet.
Okay, so basically in Zoo City, for your listeners, it's a universe where criminals are saddled with magical animals. It's kind of a curse. And you can spot a criminal a mile away because they're walking down the road with an aardvark or an emu or whatever it is. And one of the shady businesses which has kind of sprung up around this kind of segregated area of society in the ghetto is dogfighting, where you have a boxing match between people, but their animals also fight. And I really wanted to have a dogfighting scene in the novel. And it would have slowed down the pace. There was no space for it. There was no purpose for it. It would have been completely gratuitous, but it's something I was very, very interested in. And if I was to do a sequel, I'd be very interested in kind of exploring that scene, as well as kind of the seedy, kind of sex aspect, human trafficking, that kind of thing. I'd be very interested in getting into that.
So you said that these universes are on their own and they're self-consistent between the different the three different books, but they all have a South African style. They all have they exist in a universe where South Africa exists. They exist in a universe where townships exist and where corporations exist. Is that simply because you're South African, or have you thought about? Was it just natural? Because as an American reader reading it, while I do have familiarity with South Africa, we're on Earth, we're in South Africa. You know, it's unclear if we're in a parallel universe or if we're 20, 30 years in the future. That's all unclear. But there is a lot of givens. It didn't need to be on Earth in South Africa, in a place where race existed and things like that. What do you think about things like that?
You know, I think the best science fiction and fiction tells us something about who we are and where we are right now, but specifically who we are. And as much as I admire someone like China Mirabal and his most recent book, Embassy Town, is the most incredible novel about aliens and how language works, and it's all about kind of metaphor, and it's absolutely fantastic. I don't know if I could write that kind of thing, because I'm most interested in where we are right now and saying something about the state of where we are right now. And I feel like I have to write as close as possible to where we are. And there might be some ridiculous conceit like time travel or magical animals, but it's still very much based on our world, and very close to our world. And that's, for me as a writer, that's what interests me most. And I'm very interested in social issues, and I'm very interested in race. And, you know, to some extent, all my novels are kind of apartheid allegories about segregation and about artificial divides imposed between people. But the first two novels that were South African because, you know, that's what I wanted to write. And you write what you know. The new novel is actually set in Chicago, and that was partly because I didn't want to have to deal with, apartheid. You know, I wanted to just be able to concentrate on this high concept of a time traveling serial killer and not make it a history of apartheid. So it made sense to make it much more of a generic kind of American novel, And it's been amazing getting into Chicago history. It's been absolutely fascinating. I've been having a fantastic time.
Has that been tricky as an African trying to write about America in a clear voice that is authentic?
My publisher likes it so far. But I also lived in America for 6 months in New York and then 6 months in Chicago back in 2000, 2001. I drove 10,000 miles across the USA and Canada in a 67 VW Beetle in 1996. And my brother and I just broke down every second town. Do not do transcontinental in a 67 VW Beetle, trust me.
It's like every movie where someone breaks down and then they have to like find like the shadiest guy in town to fix their car, except you did it in multiple cities.
Yeah. And we even broke down in a town called Hope. It was great. It was, yeah.
Arkansas?
No, it was somewhere in Canada, near Vancouver, I think. Yeah, it was dire. But so I have lived in the States, and I'm going to Chicago for a reconnaissance mission as well. Just to, you know, although I live there, there's a lot of kind of, I'm digging quite deep into the social history as well. So I really want to go and visit different locations. I'm lining up some historians to take me around and again, just talking to people.
When you're writing a book like that, do you have a sense that it could be 300 pages or 800 pages?
I write until the story's done. And then my editor says, okay, you need to add 10,000 words or 20,000 words. I'm like, oh, really? And then I go back and flesh it out.
Why do they care?
A book has to be a certain length. Like, a book should be about 80,000 to 100,000 words. I don't know why. It's the rules.
So you write until you're done.
Mm.
And then they say add more or there's too many notes.
But you know what? Like, with Zoo City, the first draft I wrote was, I think, 60,000 words.
Mm-hmm.
And then they came back and said, listen, you need to explain more about the world. It was a very lean, mean draft.
Mm.
So I don't actually have a problem with that. You know, I love being pushed. You know, I want my editor to push me and make the story as best it possibly can be. I'm not precious. I'm not like, oh no, it's my precious baby. You can't touch it. It's like, well, you can touch it, but you better make it better.
What did District 9, the movie District 9, I felt the thing that was great about District 9 is that it said that an extremely compelling science fiction movie can be made on a reasonable budget that has a uniquely South African tone and be a commercial success. When that happened, did that make you think that Zoo City could be a movie? And do you play that kind of imaginary thing where you sell Zoo City and you make it a movie and it becomes this amazing thing like District 9?
It's been optioned as a movie, and I'm working on the screenplay at the moment.
So what does that mean, optioned?
It means, I assume real estates work the same way in America as they do in South Africa. It's like when an estate agent says that they will sell your house, but they want exclusivity. So they can put their boards up outside the house.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Okay.
Okay, I'll start again because that clearly doesn't make sense.
No, that's okay. So you're saying that some movie studio says, I want to make this movie.
Yes.
I don't know if I will, but I want to be involved.
No, the movie producer says, I am going to pay you a certain amount of money mm-hmm. for exclusivity to try and sell this movie to raise the money because...
Oh, to sell it?
Yeah. Well, no, to raise the money. Okay. So she wants to make it. It's a producer called Helena Spring. So she has paid an option. She has the option automatically renews every year for 3 years with a set amount of money each year. It's not a fortune. And during that gives her 3 years to try and raise the funding. In the meantime, I have set commitments. I have to write the script. I have to write a second draft of the script. And then she sends that out to potential investors and hopefully raises the full amount within those 3 years to then actually go forward into pre-production and you know, finding production and shooting.
This is all based entirely on the strength of the script and then the commercial success of the book? Or do you have like, because I'm thinking about this again as a computer person, because I'm imagining, well, then she should be going with like storyboards and concept art and a picture of what Zinzi looks like. And that
yeah,
kind
no,
of
definitely.
Stuff.
No, that the script has to come first. We've got this amazing South African concept art company, Hero Concept Design, and they did a lot of work on the Judge Dredd movie. And they're just waiting for the script. They're ready to go. They're very, very excited. And of course you need all that. You need to give people like a real sense and a feel.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, she's also going to be, as soon as she's got a script, she can then start sending that out to directors and then you want to attach a director. And then, you know, obviously the director will want to make it their own project as well. And they might require script changes and they might want to direct the concept art. So yeah, but it's a process. I mean, 99% of movies don't happen. And the 1% that do take between 4 and 10 years to happen. So right now, because, you know, you're talking about millions and millions of dollars. So, yeah. So right now it's really fun and I'm really enjoying it and I'm getting to write the screenplay and I'm getting to have a conversation and talking about, ooh, who would be great for the casting.
That's the best part, isn't it?
I know. It's fantastic. But in the meantime, you know, I'm not holding it out for it to be an absolute definite. It'll be really amazing and wonderful if it happens. But in the meantime, I've got other books to write and it's really exciting and fun, and I hope it does happen.
How do you deal with... I thought you had this one book that you're working on, but you have a screenplay, and you have the other work, and you're writing for Vertigo Comics. How do you decide what you're going to work on today? And, I mean, the psychic weight of this multitasking must be difficult to manage.
It is difficult. It's kind of like, damn it, why couldn't this stuff have come out, you know, happened 3 years ago? But, you know, I've always had a day job and written novels at the same time. You know, whether I was a journalist or a scriptwriter, and that's quite tough to write all day and then come home at night and write some more, especially with a 3-year-old. But yeah, it's just management and it's deadlines. So, you know, Vertigo, I obviously have specific deadlines, and what I might do is, you know, if I have a deadline on Friday, I might work Monday, Tuesday on my Vertigo comic, and then Wednesday I work on the screenplay, mornings Thursday I'll work on the novel. So it's just kind of balancing morning and afternoon, working after hours.
What is the Vertigo comic that you're working on?
I'm working on an offshoot of Bill Willingham's Fables. It's called Fairest. It's I don't know how much you know about the Fables universe. It's a really cool concept. It's been going for several years and huge seller. It's won multiple Eisner Awards. And it's about fairy tale refugees living in the real world. So you've got Snow White and the Big Bad Wolf, and they're all kind of hiding out in New York City. And I'm doing the story of Rapunzel, and it's a six issue arc, and I'm basically going into territory which hasn't really been explored before in Japan and kind of Japanese fairy tales. But it's very contemporary. There's lots of sex and violence, and my arc is very dark, actually. I'm working with an artist, Inaki Miranda, and he's just amazing to work with. And that's one of the things I absolutely love is collaboration. And working in animation for a long time and working in the animation studio where you could kind of liaise with the animators just to see what someone else brings to the process and how they interpret your words and turn that into a drawing and how often that'll be even cooler than you imagined. And they'll just add one detail and you're like, yes, why didn't I think of that? And it's really exciting to do that.
That's cool. I'm kind of the same way when it comes to, we call it pairing in the programming. I mean, you're always greater than the sum of your parts. You know, I mean, just to sit with another person, you come up with so much more amazing stuff than if you come up with it on your own.
Definitely. I mean, other minds are astonishing. Actually, in Zoo City, three of the chapters are guest written by other people. Yeah, and one of the best chapters as well. I'm like, damn it, I wish I thought of that. The in between, the found materials in between, mm-hmm. Like the IMDb page, or there's a psychology paper and all kinds of different things. Mm-hmm. That was something that I added after I'd done the first lean mean draft, mm-hmm. was I went back and added all those things. And I was running up against my deadline and I spoke to a friend of mine who is a music journalist. And I said, look, I would like to do a music interview with, my antagonist, who's a music producer. And I'd like to kind of throw that in. Can I look at some of your old interviews to kind of to see exactly how you do it and how you structure it and kind of use that as inspiration? And he was like, well, why don't you just let me interview your character? And I was like, okay, Evan, you know he's not real, right? He's in my head. He's like, yeah, let's do it. So he ended up writing the interview. So I had this amazing music journalist, this amazing South African music journalist, very well known, guest write a chapter. And it worked out so well that I asked two people I know who'd been involved in the Moxieland short story competition, which my publisher had run, and they'd won. And I asked them to write guest chapters as well. And they just wrote the most fantastic, amazing chapters, which was stuff I hadn't thought of. And the one, which was the psychology paper, and I don't think you've got to that point yet, but it basically questions the essence of my entire world. And I'm like, what are you doing? But it was amazing. It was wonderful because that's exactly what happens in the real world, is that mm-hmm. we do question things and we do, you know, like have completely different theories of the world and how things work. And it was so exciting to have that. And I love getting fan fiction and I love seeing fan art. It's amazing to see other people playing with your ideas.
That is a great idea. I love the music interview idea. That's brilliant.
It was really cool.
I'll totally interview your character.
I know. It was amazing. So obviously he wrote it and then I went back and tweaked to make sure that it was completely coherent with the plot and then sent it back to him and yeah.
Oh, this makes me even more excited to finish the book. So we're going to put links up to Zoo City and Moxieland, and as well as your blog and your Twitter, so people can get involved in the Lauren Bugis world. And I would very much encourage people to pick up Zoo City. I bought it myself. I bought it on Kindle. Although I feel like I should give you, Amazon's in between us. I feel I should just give you money.
No, totally. Just give me money. Yeah, absolutely.
Everyone just PayPal Lauren money because she'll get more than if you buy it from Amazon. But definitely check those out. And thank you so much for chatting with us today.
Thank you.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.